Good morning, everyone. Today we're reading in Book 2, Canto 3, The Glory and the Fall of Life, starting on page 116. Page 116. Last week we completed Canto 2, and we just read the first section of Canto 3. So today we'll read it again and look at it in more detail and perhaps move on to section 2. Manoha, would you start?
Glory and the fall of life. An even broad ascent now moved his feet. Answering greater nature's troubled call, he crossed the limits of embodied mind and entered wide, obscure, disputed fields, where all was doubt and change and nothing sure. A world of search and toil without repose. As one who meets the face of the unknown, a questioner with none to give reply, attracted to a problem never solved, always uncertain of the ground he trod, always drawn on to an inconstant goal, he traveled through a land peopled by doubts, in shifting confines on a quaking base. In front he saw a boundary ever unreached and thought himself at each step nearer now, a far-reaching horizon of mirage.
Thank you. The previous canto was the kingdom of subtle matter. Like our world, it's a world of forms, of shapes, limited beings, but one of perfect beauty. But Asvapati is on his quest, he's just started on his quest for a power of existence, a principle that will be able to bring about a divine life in our material world. And although there he sees divine images of great beauty of what is here, what was here, what will be here, he finds that physical world, it's also a physical world, subtle physical, limiting. He says it's like a perfect picture in a perfect frame. It's just the way it is. There's no possibility of change or anything more perfect. It's perfection in a small space, many, many perfect forms. So that can't satisfy him at all. No? And the last lines of the previous canto on page 115, the poet says, "Our spirit tires of being's surfaces. Transcended is the splendor of the form. It turns to hidden powers and deeper states." This is that spirit gets tired of all these beautiful surfaces. He's looking for something truer and deeper. So now he looks beyond that kingdom of subtle matter. He's looking for a greater light. And so Sri Aurobindo shows a King Asvapati to us, leaving that beautiful world, that brilliant courtyard of the House of Days. He leaves that fine material paradise. His destiny lay beyond, in larger space. And the world that he moves into, well, first there's a transition. An uneven, broad ascent now lured his feet. He's moving beyond this subtle physical world, which is the closest in the world stair to our own. He's going up a step. He's responding to the troubled call of a greater nature, not just a purely physical nature, but one that is deeper and has greater possibilities. So he crosses the limits of embodied mind. He moves into a space which is more fluid and formless, where the forms are not so fixed, and entered wide, obscure, disputed fields. It's not clear who owns and rules and controls these spaces that he's moving into. There seems to be some disagreement, some conflict about what powers govern there. And in those wide, obscure, disputed fields, all was doubt and change and nothing sure. This is the unpredictability of life. And King Asvapati is himself a questioner. And in that world, he doesn't find anybody to give a reply. But he's very much attracted towards this problem that has never yet been solved. But as he moves forward, he's always unsure of his footing. It's quite dangerous, unstable ground. But still, he's attracted onwards. But even the goal, even the end that he's trying to move towards is inconstant. It seems to be shifting and moving. So we see him traveling through a land peopled by doubts, by questions and uncertainties. Even the borders of that realm are shifting, shifting confines on a quaking base. It's like earthquake country or swamp where the ground is not stable. He can see a horizon, a boundary in front of him, but he never seems to be able to reach it. With each step, he thinks he's getting nearer and nearer to that boundary, but the horizon is retreating, a far retreating horizon of mirage. It may not really even exist. It may be just an illusory appearance. This is the approach to the vital world, away from the physical into a subtler state, the life worlds. Now we're embarking on the life worlds. There are six cantos, starting here with the glory and the fall of life. And then Sri Aurobindo shows us about the evolution of life in matter. And finally, in Canto 8, end of Canto 8, King Asvapati does find a kind of solution. He found the mystic key to nature's change. And because of this realization that he has, he's projected into the paradise of the life gods, Canto 9. So these are the six cantos that deal with the life mind, the life worlds. And then he will move on to the mind worlds. There are also several levels of mind. Then the world of soul. And finally, the kingdom of the greater knowledge. And there Sri Aurobindo shows us that Asvapati has actually reached the highest level of this manifestation. That's the end of book two. But he still hasn't found what he's searching for. So he will have to go yet further in book three. Yes?
In line 15, at the end, there is this little black line. What does it mean?
It's a dash. It's continuing the meaning. It means that this far-retreating horizon of mirage, it describes the experience which is described in the previous two lines. In front he saw a boundary ever unreached and thought himself at each step nearer now. And that boundary, he comes to the conclusion that it's a mirage. So one could put colon, but sometimes we can put a dash. Shall we go on? Lela?
And then you see one there, that group no home, a journey of countless paths without a goal. Nothing he found to satisfy his heart. A tireless wandering sought and could not cease. There, life is the manifest incalculable, a movement of unquiet seas, a long and venturous leap of spirit into space, a vexed disturbance in the eternal calm, an impulse and passion of the infinite.
Thank you. There, he uses the word twice, no? A vagrancy was there, and then at the end, there life is the manifest incalculable. So where is he just now? I think that this is my interpretation, that he's in a kind of subtle representation of our life. Here, of course, we are in matter, and these things get expressed in material forms and experiences, but the subtle nature of the life that we know is like this, full of doubts and uncertainties and shifting goals and a far retreating horizon of mirage. So he says, in that realm, maybe we can think of it as a kind of transitional zone, there's a vagrancy which brooked no home. Here the word brook means to allow, to permit. There's a state of vagrancy. Vagrancy means not having a home, having to wander always because you have no permanent residence. In some countries it's a crime to be a vagrant and not to have a home. So it seems to be the nature of that world. It doesn't allow anybody or anything there to have a home, to be sure where they belong and where they can be safe. No? So he experiences it as a journey of countless paths, and it never comes to an end, no close. And Asvapati himself, on his search, he doesn't find anything that satisfies him. He has to go on and on with this journey. This is the nature of the ordinary life that we know. It's the manifest incalculable. We think that we have certain certainties, but life is always surprising us. No? Things don't work out the way we expect. We think we've got everything settled and whoops, something comes in. Life is incalculable. So Sri Aurobindo likens it to the movement of a sea, troubled, stormy seas. It's this world seems to have come about because spirit has taken some kind of a leap into emptiness, a venturous leap, a leap spirit doesn't know where it's going. It's also incalculable. It seems to be a vexed disturbance in the eternal calm. There's this eternal calm which is always supporting the worlds. But in this particular area, that calm is disturbed, troubled, irritated and anxious. But he says, nevertheless, this has come about through an impulse and a passion of the infinite. The infinite one has been attracted to this kind of experience, this kind of troubled state. So in the next passage, Sri Aurobindo will speak of life as she. Would you read? Assuming whatever shape, yes? Unshepherded.
Unshepherded by the crowded world's new time. Unshepherded by the fate of death and
Disaster. Thank you. So this is life. Life is not tied down to inhabit any particular forms. She can assume whatever shapes her fancy wills. She's escaped from the restraint of settled forms. In our world, we have living forms. No? The life force inhabits them. When it's dissatisfied with the form, it moves on, new ones. And another characteristic of life is that she loves the unexpected and unpredictable. She's left behind the safety of the tried and known. Perhaps we here in this world of fixed forms, more or less fixed forms, he gives the image of a shepherd looking after his sheep. And he says that life doesn't have a shepherd, doesn't have a protector and a guide to prevent it falling off a cliff or eating the wrong thing or being attacked by lions. She doesn't care about those things, the spirit of life. She's not shepherded by this fear that walks through time. Perhaps our fear here in this world of shape and form and fixed forms and time, our fear is that we will have to lose our body. No? But she's not bothered about that at all. So she's not daunted, she's not put off by fate, fate that is always dogging us. I don't know whether you know this noun, it's rather nice. A good dog will always follow at his master's heel. No, he's always there. He doesn't rush off and front and chase rabbits. He's always here. So something that dogs us is like that. It's always with us, always by our side. So one of the things that's always by our side is fate. But she doesn't have to bother about that. She doesn't have to bother about the chance happenings that leap out of you, out at you from nowhere. Such a striking characteristic of our life. You think you've got everything settled and suddenly the computer crashes and there's only 24 hours to fulfill the commitment and so on. You know, these things happen. Chance springs on us. Sometimes good chance, sometimes not so good. Life doesn't care much about that. She accepts disaster as a common risk. Of course it's like that, and it just makes the adventure more interesting. She's careless of suffering. She's heedless. She doesn't pay any attention to what we think of as sin, of going seriously wrong in our relationship with the universe, and fall. She's happy to wrestle with danger and discovery in the unexplored expanses of the soul. The soul has immense expanses to be explored. Life wants to explore them all. Sudhanya?
To be seen only in long explaining, the hunger of the seeking, ignoring force that tries all good and finding none supreme, moves on unsatisfied, unsure of the same, as saw some in our mind, so life was said. From thought to he passed, from phase to phase, tortured by her own faults, her proud and bliss, now master of herself, now toy and slave, a huge inconsequence was her action's law, as if all possibility must be drained, and anguish and dreams were
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything about this passage?
Yes, sir.
Mm.
From this, I understand life has got its own fancy and it's free and wants to explore even the soul, the soul's thing.
Yes.
But does the soul have got a say on the life, or life is independent of the soul?
Here in this world, I think, it's as if the soul is in the background. This is where the life expresses itself, its own impulses. In our life, everything is connected. So the soul does have some influence. It doesn't always exercise its influence very much. We will read later on, Sri Aurobindo expresses how, or we have read in Canto 4, how the soul just stands back and lets nature do what it wants, even in our state, until a certain degree of development has been reached, and then the soul can step forward and take charge. But here, one by one, he's showing us these different, more or less independent planes of existence. And we said last week that these are not evolutionary planes. They are states of being. So it's very difficult for us to imagine worlds in which there is no impulse for progress. What is typical of this life world is the impulse for change, for constant change and variety. And we will later see that there is a kind of, when he comes to the evolution of life in matter, that there is something pushing from behind the consciousness. But that's not his theme here.
Why should the soul hold back?
I saw it beautifully expressed a couple of days ago, but now I can't remember exactly the formulation. But I think he says the soul holds back to allow the nature to explore the whole universe and all its possibilities. Something like that. He's created this amazing universe, not only this material world, but all the subtle worlds as well. And the nature is given the freedom to explore all that, perhaps like we would have with a young child, you know. We don't tell it, you've got to do this and learn that and do the other. We tend to leave it free to explore and find out for itself. Something like that, perhaps.
And in this here also dynamic journey and the dynamic creation, through this freedom to explore always new fields.
But it's not like the mind. The mind is interested in progress, in improvement. Life doesn't care about that. Life just wants change, fun, delight, enjoyment, and all different kinds, things that we might not think as enjoyable at all.
After death, the soul also travels to some of these planes?
It travels through them.
Our soul.
Yes, our individual soul. Yes.
Before the next birth.
Yes. And in a way, what is described here in Asvapati's journey, it might correspond to those realms of experience that our individual being might have after leaving the body. Probably we won't have all of them in such clarity and variety as King Asvapati has, because Sri Aurobindo is trying to show us the whole range of possibilities. No? But that's what we will see, the whole range of possibilities, until in Canto 14 we come to the world of soul. And there the soul can make its choice where it wants to go next. And of course, I think it is Asvapati's, we can say his central being, that is choosing to make this journey. And it's the choices of his central being that lead him from one level to another. Not only up, but also down for this incredible exploration. But for life, just being, just existing, is an unlimited experiment, a bit like our experiments in Oroville, where we are more interested in the experiment than in the findings and the results and the achievements. No? And this huge experiment is done by hazard, by chance, in a random way, by this seeking, ignorant force, our life being. And that seeking, ignorant life force tries all truths, tests everything, and doesn't find any supreme, convincing truth. So it moves on, unsatisfied, without knowing really where it's going, unsure of its end. And yet there is some kind of guidance. There's a mind, there's a consciousness, some inner mind. As saw some inner mind, so life was shaped. From thought to thought she passed, from phase to phase, and all through all different kinds of experiences, tortured by her own powers, or proud and blessed, sometimes master of herself, sometimes toy and slave. If we think of the life energies as horses, no, sometimes they are controlled, they go where we want them to do, and other times they run away with us. Then we're the toy and slave of our vital impulses. And there's no kind of sequence in all this. It's not that one thing is tried out and then methodically you try the next. It says that there's a huge inconsequence was the law of her action. It's really random. It's as if all possibility must be drained, drunk down, the whole cup of possibility. And anguish and bliss, intense suffering, intense delight. That's just pastimes of the heart. Your pastimes are things you just do to pass the time, you know, not with any purpose, just for relaxation, for fun. So these intense experience, extremes of experience, intense suffering or intense delight, it's all equal to her. It's just experience. So now he, very wonderful images, he describes the variety of some of these different states. Lorraine, would you read? In a gallop.
In a gallop, a thunder boom vicissitudes, she swept through the race fields of circumstance, or swaying she tossed between her heights and depths, uplifted or broken on time's inconstant wheel, amid a tedious crawl of drab desires, she writhed. A worm made worms in nature's mind. Then, saturated, took all earth for food. Ambition, the seeds, her robe, her crown, the stars. And shouting strode from peak to giant peak, clamoring for worlds to conquer and to rule. Then, wantonly enamored, sorrow's face, she plunged into the anguish of the depths, and wallowing clung to her own misery. And Dolores conversed with her squandered self. She wrote the account of all that she had lost, or sat with grief, as with an ancient friend. A rump of violent raptures soon was spent, or she lingered tied to an inadequate joy, missing the turns of fate, missing life's goal.
Thank you. There's quite a lot of difficult words in this passage. Anybody wants to ask anything? You get the picture. these contrasting states. You can notice the life force sometimes wallowing, clinging to its misery, and you want to cheer it up, and no. It clings, wallows in its misery. Self-pity. And then the way that our life sometimes lingers, it knows that this state that it's in is an inadequate joy. It's a little joy, but it's really not enough. But still, the life clings to it, missing the turns of fate, opportunity, missing life's goal. It's tragic that this happens. No? Would you like to read, Mom? Yes?
The scene was planned for all the numberless moons, where each could be the law and way of life, but none could offer a pure felicity. Only a flickering zest they left behind, all the fears, lust that brings the dead, fatigue. Are meters with untold verity. Something remained dissatisfied, ever the same, and in the new saw only a face of the old. For every hour repeated all the rest, and every change prolonged the same unease. The spirit of the self, an aim unsure, tired soon of too much joy and happiness. She needs the spur of
pleasure
and of pain, and the native taste of suffering and unrest. She strains for an end that never can she win. A perverse savour hounds her thirsting lips for the grief she weeps, which came from her own choice, or the pleasure yearns that rake with wounds her breast. Aspiring to heaven, she turns her steps towards hell. Chance she has chosen and danger for playfellows. Fate's dreadful swing she has taken for cradle and seat. Yet pure and bright from the timeless was her birth. A lost world rapture lingers in her eyes. Her moods are faces of the infinite. Beauty and happiness are her native right, and endless bliss in her eternal home.
I think we can recognize this spirit, this spirit of life. She's lost. She's unsure of who she is and where to go. So, distraction. She gets tired soon of too much joy and happiness. She needs this spur. A spur, you know, it's the metal piece that horsemen have on their boots to dig into the side of the horse to make it go faster. The spur. The alternating spur of pleasure and pain. She needs this taste of suffering and unrest. She's full of effort. She's always ready to make some effort, straining for some aim. But she never reaches that goal. And there's something perverse. She wants a delight that is actually not a delight, no? She enjoys weeping for the grief that has come about. No, she knows it has come because of her own choice. And she yearns for certain kinds of pleasures that she knows very well will wound and hurt her. In the life force, there's a tremendous aspiration, power of aspiration to the heights. But she also turns to the depths. She has chosen chance and danger for for her playfellows, her companions. Yet, pure and bright from the timeless was her birth. A lost world rapture lingers in her eyes. Her moods are faces of the infinite. Beauty and happiness are her native right, and endless bliss is her eternal home. For me, these lines encapsulate one of the unique features of Sri Aurobindo's spirituality. He recognizes the divineness of life and all its impulses, and emphasizes to us that the goal of life and our goal shouldn't be to turn away from all these things. Her moods are faces of the infinite. All these things have a significance. Rejecting life is not what Sri Aurobindo wants us to do. And in the next section, he's going to show that something of that eternal home of life, the world of bliss. Yes, I was just thinking we have to read, no? I think we can read. We can read to page 128. That's actually three sections. Bhakti, would you read? Thank you. Petra?
A path in the self-glory plunged, remote, burning they swam in a vague, mute place. An everlasting refuge of dreamlight, a nebula of the splendors of the gods made from the musings of eternity, almost unbelievably by human faith, no, almost unbelievable by human faith. Hardly they seem the stuff of things that are, as through a magic television's glass, outlined to some magnifying inner eye, they shone like images thrown from a far scene, too high and glad for mortal lids to cease, but near and real to the longing heart, and to the body's passionate thought and sense, are the hidden kingdoms of beatitude, and some close unattained realm which yet we feel, immune from harsh clutch of death and time, escaping the surge of sorrow and desire, in bright, enchanted, safe territories, forever wallowing in bliss they lie. In dream and trance and muse before our eyes, across the subtle vision's inner field, wide, rapturous landscapes fleeting from the sight, the figures of the perfect kingdom pass, and behind them leave a shining memory's trail, imaged scenes of great eternal worlds. Dream caught or sensed, they touch our hearts with their depths, unreal seeming, yet more real than life, happier than happiness, truer than things true. If dreams these were but captious images, dreams truth make false earth's vain realities. In a swift eternal moment fixed, they live forever recalled, come back to longing eyes, calm heavens of imperishable light, illumined continents of violet peace, oceans and rivers of the mirth of God, and griefless countries under purple suns.
Thank you. So beautiful. The kingdoms of the griefless life. You would read, sir? Would you read?
This, once a star of bright remote idea, or imagination's comet trail of dream, took now a close shape of reality. The gulf between dream truth, earth fact was crossed. The wonder worlds of life were dreams no more. His vision made all, they unveiled its own. Their scenes, their happenings, met his eyes and heart, and smote them with pure loveliness and bliss. A breathless summit region drew his gaze, whose boundaries jutted into a sky of self, and dipped towards a strange, ethereal base. The quintessence, load of life's supreme delight. On a spiritual and mysterious peak, only a myriad's high transfiguring line divided life from the formless infinite and sheltered time against eternity. Out of that formless stuff, time mints his shapes, and eternal's quiet holds the cosmic act.
Thank you. Mihong?
The 14 images of the world force have drawn the strength to be, the will to last from a deep ocean of dynamic peace, inverting the spirit's apex towards life. She spent the plastic liberties of the one to cast in act the dreams of her caprice. His wisdom's call steadies her careless feet. He props her dance upon her rigid face, his timeless still immutability. Must stand eyes her creation's miracle. Out of the boy's unseen energies, inventing the scene of a concrete universe, by his thought she has fixed its paces. In its blind act she sees by flashes of his own glowing light at her will. The inscrutable supermind leans down to guide her course, the fields her cannot know. Its breath of power controls her restless seas and life obeys the governing idea, at a will led by a luminous immanence, the hazardous experimenting mind pushes its way through obscure possibilities, mid chance formations of an unknowing world. Our human ignorance moves towards the truth. The omniscient may become omniscient. Transmitted instincts shape to divine thoughts. Thoughts pass infallible immortal sight, and nature climbs towards God's identity.
Thank you. Yes.
After this line 85, it's a different type. He's giving explanation of the claim.
After line 90.
Then even 86, from 86 onwards.
Yes.
He's giving the background of that.
At the source, the origin of life. Pure and bright from the timeless was her birth. Life has been born from the Supreme, pure and bright, without any perversity or ignorance or anything.
The rest of the paragraph is just following that line of thinking.
Then when we come to the new paragraph, the new section, Asvapati sees that eternal home of bliss. That is what is described in the next section, or just evoked in the next section. It's, yes, we can see different steps, no? There's the life as it is in our experience, and there's the griefless home of life. And we'll see that King Asvapati is able to, his sight, he's able to see and know about that world, but he can't enter it. Why can't he enter it? And then Sri Aurobindo explains why. And then he gives us the wonderful picture of the life principle involving itself in matter, in response to a kind of aspiration in matter. Poof, down she comes, this goddess, hoping to fill a fair new world with joy. The idea of a world of living matter. But the trouble is that matter isn't able to express this life principle. It just gets swallowed up. She becomes a prisoner in matter. And from that, she has to evolve. Life has to evolve in matter. From the smallest, minutest, most primitive little life movements, he follows all this. He says, if we look at that stage, we really wonder what's the use of this, you know, this life, all these swarming tiny viruses and bacteria and amoebas and whatever it is. But then he says, Sri Aurobindo, Asvapati has a spiritual view, and he sees that it's not useless. It's a very necessary step towards the emergence of consciousness in matter. And he describes that step by step. First the plant emergence, then the animal creation, and finally the beginning of some emergence of mind. That all comes in Canto 4. It's one of the longer cantos, and it's a very, very interesting one, a step by step emergence from the subtle point of view, not exactly from the biologist's point of view, but it corresponds to the bio. If the biologists would read it and understand, I think many of the puzzles that they have about the emergence of life would be solved, because Sri Aurobindo is always looking below the surface and showing that things are not happening on the surface. What appears on the surface is a result of deep inner movements and an intention, you know. Where were we, Naren? Where did you stop me?
It's
Sorry, it's on page 121, no? The Master of the Worlds. Yes, Jean-Yves, will you read for us?
The Master of the Worlds, self-made as slave, is the executor of her fantasies. She has canalized the seas of omnipotence. She has limited by her laws, illimitable.
Can I just interrupt for a moment? Sorry, Jean-Yves. I feel I have to explain the difference between the world force and the life spirit. Here in this page, he's talking about the supreme conscious force, which is the mother of the worlds. And the life spirit is one of her expressions. But in this page, which we're reading now, 121, he's really speaking about the world force, the universal mother, and her work, and what is her connection with the Lord. He allows her to do her work. He's collaborating and supporting all that. Sorry, Shani, please continue.
He labors at the tasks her ignorance sets, hidden in the cave of our mortality, the worlds, the forms her goddess fancy made, have lost their origin on unseen times, even severed, strayed from their timeless source, even deformed, obscure, accursed and fallen, since even form has its perverted joy, and nothing leaves out that serves delight. These too can to the peaks revert, or here cut out the sentence of the spirit's fall, recover their forfeited divinity. As once caught in an eternal vision's sweep, he saw her pride and splendor of high-born souls, and her regions crouching in the nether deeps. Above was a monarchy of a fallen self, beneath was a gloomy trance of the abyss, an opposite pole of dim antipodes. There were vasts of the glory of life's absence, all locked in a safe immortality and an eternal childhood of the soul. Before darkness came, and pain and grief were born, where all could dare to be themselves and one, and wisdom played in sinless innocence, with naked freedom, in truth's happy sun.
Thank you, Naren.
There were words of laughter and dreadful heaven. There were feelings of a taste of toil and strife and tears. Her head lay on the breast of Amara's death. Sleep imitated a wild extension's peace. The light of God she has parted from his dark to test the savor of their opposites. Her mingling
here on earth.
Here on mingling in man's heart, their tones and hues, their woman is being's mutable design, is life a forward ripping stream in time, is nature's constant fixed mobility, is soul a moving picture's changeful film, is cosmos chaos of personality. The grand creatrix of her cryptic touch has turned to pathos and power being's self-dreaming, made a passion play of its fathomless mystery.
Thank you. King Aswapati, starting on line 217. Is able to see all at once the whole range of all the different planes of life. At once caught in an eternal vision sweep, he saw her pride and splendor of high-born zones and her regions crouching in the nether deeps, the terrible lower lives, life levels. Above was a monarchy of unfallen self. It's able to rule itself the true self, the one. But beneath was the gloomy trance of the abyss, all the lower levels of existence. And then he describes some of the different levels. We'll look at it next time. All these different worlds which Aswapati could see. And then he says that the world force, the creatrix, has separated. She has parted the light of God from his dark. She separated the bright and the dark aspects in order to be able to test what they taste like, the savor of bare opposite. But here on earth, they are not separated, they are mingling. Here, mingling in man's heart, all these different tones and hues have woven our being's mutable design, where we change from one thing to another. His life, man's life, is a forward rippling stream in time. Our nature is somehow in a way fixed and yet mobile. Man's soul seems to be showing or projecting a moving pictures, changeful film. The human personality is a cosmos chaos. Chaos is when there's no harmony, everything's random and mixed up. The cosmos is when everything is in a harmonious order. So these opposites meet in us. The grand creatrix, with her cryptic touch, her magic touch, she has turned being's self-dream. The dream about the dreams about itself of the pure existence. But here she's turned it all into a passion play. It's played out before us. We can see it all. She's made a passionless play of its fathomless mystery, the fathomless mystery of existence. We'll stop there today and go on next time. But I should tell you about next weekend. I think next Sunday is the 18th, isn't it? Yes. It is the Nadkarni Memorial Lecture next Sunday afternoon. The actual talk will be from 4 to 5. There'll be transport coming from Pondi for those people who need it. Buses leaving from behind the ashram. And we'll be serving light refreshments here. The talk this time will be given a second time, I mean, by Mrs. Sonia Dine, who has been studying and talking about Savitri for decades. She told me she started giving public talks about Savitri in 1976. We have found her talks extremely illuminating. And this time, she wants to share with us her insights about this book, Book 2. She's called it Inside the World Stare. She says the way we look at things, it's always from the outside. But she feels that in this book, Sri Aurobindo is showing us the universe from the inside. And she's been working in that kind of field of research for many years. She's 86. She won't be doing it again. She wants to share with us some of her major insights. So everybody's welcome next Sunday afternoon. And then in the night, 18th to 19th, 19th at 3 a.m., not p.m., a.m., in the news they've printed PM. They can't believe that we're actually going to do something at 3 a.m. But people do start for the marathon, no, early in the morning. 3 a.m. is the hour before the gods awake. It's the beginning of the poem. And at 3 a.m. on the 19th of February, we are going to start screening this complete, continuous reading of Savitri by 471 people representing 99 countries around the world. This event has been in preparation since last February. We'll be showing it. They've recorded their readings. They're all being in a big last-minute rush. Everything's being finalized so that we can be ready on the 19th. We'll be showing the complete sequence here on our screen, starting at 3 a.m., and we expect it to last about 48 hours. It will end on Mother's birthday. And everybody who's in Oroville is most welcome to drop in and out. I don't suppose anybody will want to sit here for 48 hours. We'll try to publish a kind of timetable, canto-wise, that we can tell you what time, Indian Standard Time, a particular canto will be starting. And, well, that's that. But it will also be made available. There will be a link to the internet, which will be activated from 3 a.m. on 1902, so that our readers, wherever they are in the world, will be able to watch it. And that will be a kind of permanent link. It won't just all be over on 21st. That will be accessible. And I've been helping with the previewing of this material. I must say, I'm astonished how beautifully people have read. Amazing. I can't tell you now, Patty, I'm very sorry. It seems the editors have to get to a certain stage in their work before they can reveal the link. And in any case, it won't be activated until next Monday. So, but we have got, we hope to be able to inform everybody in tomorrow or the day after.
But what will be on the screen will be only the Savitri lines. It's not video of the readers.
It's the videos of the readers. In some cases, people were shy about being filmed when they were reading, and then they have provided us with images, either a still photograph or a photograph of a place that's very important to them. But these images also, they're absolutely breathtaking. I'm amazed. So...
You're able to listen to all readers?
If you're patient enough and if you can stay awake, you can do that. But if you want to just pick your favorite canto or your favorite country, for example, Mukta Rama will be there reading for Uzbekistan. So we're going around the world. The first passages, actually, are read in the ashram. Managing trustee of the ashram, Sri Manoj Das Gupta, has recorded the author's note. And then our dear elder brothers and sisters will read. And the whole of book one and part of book two, I think up to canto nine, will be read in India. It starts in the ashram, and then it goes to Kolkata, Sri Aurobindo's birthplace, and then to other centers around India. And finally, the last one will be Sri Aurobindo Ashram, Delhi. And from there, it moves to Kathmandu, where there's a wonderful reading from Sri Ramachandra. He was here the other, a couple of months ago and took our breaths away with his reading. Yeah. And then it moves into Central and West Asia, and then, you know, through all these troubled countries. We have people reading from Turkey, Syria, Jordan, Israel, Egypt, Ethiopia. Then I think we move to Kenya, Rwanda, Reunion, South Africa, and then up the coast of Africa. And from there, we move into Europe. I think we move from Algeria to Greece. And then it goes around Europe, moves to the Americas, North America first, Central, South America, and then across the Pacific to New Zealand and Australia, and then up through East Asia, Korea, I mean China, Philippines, and then again to South Asia, Singapore, Myanmar, Thailand, and then to Sri Lanka, and then it'll end up here in South India, in Auroville. The last parts are read here in Auroville. So that's the plan. We pray for blessings that everything will run smoothly.
But in 48 hours, all full Savitri will be covered.
This is an estimate. We don't know exactly. People read at different speeds. Some people read very fast. Some people read very slow. But previous readings, parayan it is called, complete readings have been done. And people say it should be approximately 48 minutes, 48 hours. I wouldn't mind if it's 54 or whatever it is. Sorry?
Yes.
Full Savitri will be covered from beginning to end. Yes. It's a kind of sacrifice, an offering, and a lady, a French lady, who unfortunately will not be able to be with us, but she's a member of AVI France. She had a vision last February that of the whole earth with spots of light shining where Savitri was being read. And she thought that we should organize this Parayan to celebrate Auroville's 50th birthday. So that's what we're doing. Crazy idea. Poor Yeti will not be here. Yeti's got pneumonia, can't come. She has done so much work for this project, it wouldn't be happening if it weren't for Yeti. Evelyn was the one who had the vision. She is also unable to be here. I hope I will make it through to next weekend that I can be here. But the nice thing is, this is a permanent product. You know, this sequence will be there. It can be accessed. It will go on being accessed.
So. It's very touching, how everything is reading.
And the lovely thing was that everybody that we contacted with an invitation, that would you read, they said, oh, yes. They were so eager to read. And then when they made their recording, very often they said, that was just the right passage for me or for my country. No, for Uzbekistan, I think it was Umid who read, and he said, my, that's just the right passage for us.
They were requested to read certain passages.
We invited certain people where we were short of countries. In India, there was no problem. We could have had 1,000 people reading in India.
No, I mean each one selected what he wanted to read, or you asked.
No, it's all in sequence, and it's moving westward around the globe.
Oh, right.
So that's what determined what people got to read. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. So, Sonia Dine, Sunday afternoon, and then this Parayan starting on early Monday morning. I beg your pardon?
Is there a also?
I can't hear you, Tuan, sorry. On Sunday morning. Well, what do you think? No, I mean, if you feel it's a bit too much, I would agree with you.
Who is for you?
I don't like to miss this, really. So we'll meet on Sunday morning. Huh? We will need a certain amount of help with the projector. The projector's going to have to run continuously for we don't know how long. So we have arranged to rent a backup projector, and we will need nurses for the projectors going through the sequence. So if anybody likes to volunteer for that, we don't want to break down in the middle. Or you can just, you'll get the link, we'll publicize the link. I hope in the next couple of days, And then you can just sit at home and watch it on your screen or your TV or whatever you use. Praying for blessings. Yes? Sorry? You're recording the event.
No, I mean the whole event coming in, take some shots.
If you take it up, Doris, that'll be wonderful. But I've had to arrange so many things. I didn't arrange this.
Nobody was there to volunteer?
So far not, no.
Okay, I'll try.
Yeah. Or you can suggest
just
somebody.
Family,
yes. And we do have some extra clips that we, that have not been, because duplications happened here and there.
Yeah, yeah.
So that could go into a kind of making of. Yes, right.
And then we talk about it.
Anyway, I'm truly not expecting anybody to sit here for the whole thing from beginning to end. And that's why we want to publish this timetable, so you can choose, at least roughly, which canto you want to hear and which country you want to see represented. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.